Welcome to the special edition of Straight Shooter with yours truly, Stephen A. Obviously, last week I made a lot of noise because of the position that I took talking about Carmelo Anthony, the teenager that was convicted of first-degree murder. Clearly, a lot of people are misconstruing what I said. I'm not happy with the 35 years. I don't think that was the right call. And I'm certainly not happy with the makeup of the jury who didn't have one, which did not have one African-American on it. But nevertheless, a killing took place. And you knew as a result of that, he was going to have to pay some stiff consequences. But rather than get into all of that myself, what better way to handle this than bringing on a legal mind who's a brilliant legal mind, but also brilliant at hosting a television show because she hosts her own show on CNN every weeknight at 11 p.m. I'm talking about the one and only Laura Coates, who is here with me right now. Laura, good afternoon. Good afternoon. How you doing?
Great. I'm glad to see you. Thank you for having me. This is so important. Thank you.
Yes, it is. Break it down. It's one thing for him to be spending time, Carmelo Anthony, that is, this teenager that was convicted, to be scheduled to serve time in prison. It's another thing entirely for it to be a 35-year sentence, particularly considering the fact that he's a first-time offender and it wasn't judged by a jury of his peers, per se. Not that it has to be African-Americans on the jury, but one would surmise that when you say a jury of your peers is one that's judging you, it would consist of at least some African-Americans, but that was not the case. What was your initial reaction upon learning the verdict for Carmelo Anthony?
This case has been and remains really tragic to think about two teenagers who should, at the end of that day, have gone home to tell their parents how they performed at the track meet. That's all this should have been. There should never have been what transpired. And to think that we are here with both families experiencing a kind of loss that they will never be able to recover truly from, one having lost their son entirely to death, killing, the other who will now spend more than the entirety of the life he's lived right now in prison yet again. My initial reaction to this was, frankly, the word foreseeable. It was foreseeable that a jury would likely convict of some charge, whether it was one, the murder charge, or a manslaughter conviction. It was likely, given the fact that the self-defense that had been argued by the defense team did not seemingly answer the biggest questions for this jury, which goes back to, why did he have a particular weapon that day? Why did he feel that he had to use it that day? And was there an alternative way that he could have conducted himself to protect his own safety and otherwise? And the jury composition in this case, I think, is so important because no matter what you think about whether his actions were justified or not, the reason we have a jury system in this country that is premised on one's peers, not, as you said, required to be your same race, required to be your same gender, required to be your same age bracket, required to be parents, nothing like that. But a jury of people who are going to have an open mind towards the facts as they come in, the evidence as presented, and with an insight into the possibility of being able to put oneself in their shoes. That's what we premise our system on. And to have excluded any jurors who were of color based on the reasons that we were given by the prosecution, which was that one did not believe that they could have been objective. Another said that they were an educator and they didn't want to have an educator on the jury because there may have been a kind of biased grace given to high school students. Another, right, for whatever reason. It gave me pause immediately of whether there was going to be an objectivity in the deliberation process. 35 years in particular, Stephen A., is interesting because normally when we have a sentence in this country, it is based on a kind of a chart that has corresponding years and months to the types of crimes you've been convicted of in the past, the behavior you've done in this particular instance. And we use that to align what might be in line with what's fair generally. Fair not meaning an eye for an eye, but fair in the sense of what have we done before? Is it in line with what we do in a situation like this? Because remember, we're a common law state and we're a common law country, which means we use what we have done in the past as guidance for what we do in the future.
Okay.
And so this jury was able to actually give their own sentence, which doesn't happen across the country, but in Texas it did. And the reason this is so particular is because there have been other cases that have been similarly situated cases, not precise, where there had been less time given when there had been an instance like this.
That's one of the things I brought up, the case of Case and Allison. I believe that was the name, Case and Allison. It was 2022, and it was similar. I don't know all the specifics of the case, but it was similar. It was deemed similar, but nevertheless, that individual was charged with negligent criminal homicide as opposed to first-degree murder. And the difference is, whereas Carmelo Anthony was expecting to hear a sentence anywhere, the sentence could be anywhere from 5 years to life. In the case of criminal negligent homicide, well, that carries a 2 to 20 year sentence. And one was wondering, how come that wasn't accorded to Carmelo Anthony? Do we know the reasons behind that compared to a Case and Allison?
The discretion of the prosecutors reigns supreme. They have within their disposal the ability to decide whether or not they want to present certain charges or not. They gave this jury more than one option. They had the murder. They also had manslaughter. Manslaughter, think about these two distinctions. You think about murder, normally it's either premeditated, it's intentional, it's an intentional killing. You think about manslaughter, it's the idea of you acted in a certain way that had a reckless or different disregard for the life of another person that resulted in a death. So they had those two available to them. The judge is within that judge's disposal to be able to allow the jury to decide either of those things. This jury said the higher charge was the appropriate one. Now, what could have turned the page for them would have been a presentation of what they were calling passion, sudden passion. Normally, that phrase is used for someone who, like, you know, you walk in on your wife and she's sleeping with your best friend and you lose your mind. That's the heat of passion crime that people think about normally speaking. This was, they were trying to present it as the heat of passion, the sudden passion as in self-defense, that the circumstances were such that the tension was so thick that this person was kill or be killed. That did not ring true for whatever reason to this particular jury. And again, it's also about the defense, the strategy that you use in the defense. What did you present to this jury that would have made them believe that self-defense was warranted, and not only self-defense, but lethal self-defense? Now, another thing I want to point out, though, Stephen A., a lot of people have pointed out about the commentary surrounding the size of the weapon and thought, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, normally, if you were to charge a case, the length of the actual weapon being used or the type of weapon being used is so important because it can lend itself to proof of either premeditation or intentionality. If, for example, you're in a street and you pull out tweezers, you grab whatever you can and you hit someone with the tweezers, no one's thinking that I plan to bring tweezers to commit a crime. If I bring a machete, I've got a whole different ballgame here. So he was not charged with a crime about the type of weapon. It was all premised on the idea of the self-defense or not. And this jury did not buy it.
Well, listen, we're talking to Laura Coates right here with Straight Shooter on Straight Shooter with Stephen A. You know what? When you talk about sudden passion, basically meaning he acted directly out of provocation and was overwhelmed by strong emotions such as fear, shock, or anger. That's really what they're talking about when they're talking about sudden passion, as you articulated. I'm wondering whether or not that was the right course of action for the defense to take. What do we believe, what do we think about the defense that was presented on behalf of Carmelo Anthony, and whether or not that clearly it didn't suffice because he was convicted of first-degree murder. But are there any legitimate questions out there from spectators, from folks that were covering the trial, that bring into question whether or not he had actually received a viable defense in all of this?
On the appeal, they're going to look at whether he had effective assistance of counsel. That's going to be almost standard. And part of that will be about the type of defense, but not just the strategy, but whether it was put on in a way that was in line with the law, with the facts, and represented him fully and zealously as an advocate. it can't be ineffective assistance if you got a conviction alone. It's got to be something more. But on that idea of strategy, what I've heard people talk about with this case and in reading about what transpired, because there was a gag order in place, no cameras were allowed, which I have to say probably would have done a lot to have a camera in that courtroom for people to actually watch justice in action, even though he was 17 at the time, he's now 19 years old. It's not a minor issue any longer. But the idea of when you present a defense, the strategy has to be that this particular defendant had no other choice but to defend with physical action, meaning you met the level of force that you were confronted with the requisite level of force needed to repel that force. People often think about this in terms of, say, an officer shooting, although it's a very different standard. Let me bring it into this context. When I mention police officers, we think to ourselves, they make split-second decisions. The Supreme Court allows them to make split-second decisions, and we defer to what a reasonable officer similarly situated in a similar circumstance would have done. In this case, they tried to apply a similar split-second strategy decision to say they had a split-second decision to figure out and assess the danger around that person and determine. Now, officers are trained to be able to be much more objective in what they do with a split second. The average layman, let alone a 17-year-old kid, has a very different calculus involved in what threat really should look like. Yet we give a great deal of deference to police officers who get it wrong. But here, this particular defendant, people have commented that he has not gotten the same level of deference, even though he would not have been trained, would not have had the requisite level of perspective and beyond. But that's not enough for this jury and not enough for a defense team to present. They have to show that you were going to kill or be killed. If they could not show that, if they could show you could walk away from this, if they could show that there was an instance the person could have said, never mind, I'm going to leave the tent and my ego is bruised, I'm annoyed, but I could safely retreat. If they could not show that if they could show that was a possibility and that the person acted nonetheless, they cannot make out the case for self-defense to overcome the presentation of the prosecutor's case.
What about the judge choosing not to allow cameras inside the courtroom? You just alluded to that. You just brought that up. I certainly was going to bring that up. This is one of those cases where if there's no cameras in the courtroom, you're at the mercy of the judge and the lawyers and their interpretation of what transpired. You don't have a public setting that allows you to deduce what truly, truly transpired, which to me contributes to those with, you know, thoughts about how, listen, Black folks, legal system, let's be real about it. We don't exactly trust it. We don't exactly feel like it's ever going to operate in our favor. And then I'm looking at this kid, 3.7 GPA, captain of the football and the track team, you know, working a part-time, you know, working an after-school job at the Foot Locker, had no criminal record whatsoever. This is his first offense. I can understand, you know, the angst and the disgust on the part of supporters of Carmelo Anthony. But then in the same breath, I'm thinking about the father of Mr. Metcalf, who, you know, whose son was killed. His son ain't never coming back. His son is dead. So it's a hard position to take. And I think cameras in that courtroom would have helped. Like you said, was the judge justified in making that kind of decision? Or is it completely at the discretion of the judge and it's not a damn thing we could do about it?
The damn thing you could do about it. With the judge has discretion. It's not mandated by law to have those cameras in the courtroom. Therefore, it is the discretion. And I think the judge thought, and I'm giving grace here because I don't know the mindset of the judge, but many judges I speak to, when they're asked about whether to have a camera in the courtroom or not, and they have the discretion, they will say they try to avoid what they believe would be a spectacle of people being in the courtroom or trying to have the court of public opinion infiltrate the justice system, and they're trying to prevent a circus. Now, what happens, though, when you've got a very, very impassioned court of public opinion who wants desperately to understand what happened, the absence of transparency and daylight into that, it only creates further mistrust. And the pacing of a trial, because we're very used to in our criminal justice system hearing about somebody committing a crime in 2022, being charged a year later, having a trial after that, not within the last year, it all coming to fruition and being
and
done.
And not only that, that's Laura, excuse me for interjecting, not yes. only that, Laura, how about the verdict coming down, the guilty verdict, and then within hours, he gets sentenced to 35 years. They didn't even wait a day before sentencing him to 35 years.
It makes you think of that phrase, judge, jury, and executioner. Although, obviously, he is not eligible for the death penalty. He was 17 at the time, but did not pursue capital punishment in this case. But this all fuels that mistrust that is all already very much there. Now, in the courtroom, they did not try to address the racial issues, but it was the quintessential element in the room. We know that a history in America, one of the reasons you have what's called the Batson case, which is the Supreme Court case, essentially says you have to have... you cannot use race as a reason to strike a juror, is because there had been historical research and evidence presented to the Supreme Court and others to suggest that there was a higher likelihood of either conviction or harsher sentences, depending upon the race of the victim compared to the race of the particular defendant. And that was calculated into how they looked at the need to have diverse, at least not having diversity or racial diversity or race-based or gender or religion or otherwise be a reason to strike somebody. And so I think a camera in the courtroom, it wouldn't have looked at the jury, you wouldn't have seen who they were. It likely would not have changed the outcome of this case. But what it would have done is it would have allowed people to understand fully what was happening inside of that courtroom, to be able to fully understand for themselves what the basis for appeal should have been and the decision-making process of a jury and having that sentence. Well, I, for one, want more cameras in the courtroom. I've been a prosecutor. I have had to see the underbelly of our justice system. And one of the things, as you mentioned, his background, his schooling, his job, all the things, is Stephen A. I can count on one hand, in all the cases I've prosecuted, even seen, a monster. These aren't monsters we're talking about as defendants. You're talking about people who make a choice in a moment that they desperately wish they could get back. And because we know that people oftentimes, the prison systems, yeah, you've got some monsters in them. You've got the Hannibal Lecters, so to speak. But overwhelmingly, you have people who took and chose a course of action that resulted in a consequence they did not foresee and have to be punished and held to account for it. And that's why we've got all these factors that are considered right. by a judge or a jury of whether to sentence them by throwing right. the book at them or otherwise.
Laura, what do we say? Just a couple of questions, a few more questions before I let you go. And I really thank you for your time. You know, I'm thinking about it, and it's 19 as the trial was going on, but he was 17 when the crime was committed. Yes. Just the mere thought of him being tried as an adult. Some people have a problem with that. Is that a legitimate beef?
That's a beef that one should take up with the policies of the state. That is a legitimate discussion to have all across this country, that somebody who's not able to vote would be able to be tried as an adult. Somebody who's a year from driver's license, somebody who, look at any parent out there who's trying to get insurance on their car, right? With a child, a son, they will tell you that it is baked into the cake of our society and views towards a particular age, particularly of boys as well, where we say this person's not cognitively formed enough, decision-wise enough to be to get the benefit of responsibility, and yet being tried as an adult is one that one should think about very, very clearly in our society. But that was the standing policy and ability in this state, and they chose to do it.
Your thoughts about those supporters out there, primarily Black, who was speaking up on behalf of Carmelo Anthony, feeling like he was railroaded, and they feel like it's an injustice, the latest by the justice system. What do you say to those folks right now? Not just as a former prosecutor, but as a Black woman who's hosting a national television show on CNN every weeknight. What do you say to them?
Well, I'll tell you what I say to them as a mother, because that's who actually is hosting that show. This Black woman and mother of a son, of a daughter, I look at this and I say, we have to be very careful in two ways. One, careful that we do not take for granted that the pursuit of justice leads to justice. That has to be an act of intentionality every single day. The second part of it is that there are two families that are suffering, which is not unlike most cases we will see across this country. And I would be very, very intentional about the statements that are made to vilify not only the human who is the defendant, the human that is the victim of the actual stabbing, the humans that are the parents, and the humans that are the parents of both of those young men, not only Carmelo Anthony, but also Austin Metcalf and his twin brother who watched. And so I think people oftentimes want to use people's real stories as avatars for causes that they otherwise want to pursue. But when you forget about the human aspect of it, you will ultimately fail in understanding what has actually transpired. And I would just finally say that if you have a problem, and I understand the problem people have, if you have a problem with not having cameras in the courtroom, with not having judges on benches that will perhaps look at if they are elected judges and do an upward or downward departure from what a jury has found. If you have a problem with somebody being tried as an adult at the age of 17, if you have a problem with the way that you believe race is used in this country, and it is in ways that are not intended by what society believes is right, then you do have some power in your feet and in the ballot box. And you do have some power in not sitting on the sidelines complaining into your latte. You can do something about it. And the number one way to do something about it is to make sure the people who represent those who are in positions of power and authority and those who are vulnerable and can be victimized by a system, that if you want to be a champion for something, be a champion for changing the system, not the champion for complaining about it without more.
Any issue? Two more questions for you before I let you get on out of here. Any issue with either the father, Austin Metcalf's father, Jeff, and how he's handled this, or the parents of Carmelo Anthony? Any issue at all in your estimation? Based on what you've heard in the aftermath of the verdict, yes.
You know, when I have watched the interviews of both sets of parents, my heart absolutely breaks because they will be judged. They are being judged. Their parenting being judged. The choice of their children on full display. Both sides being raked over the coals for what people look at to see and judge them as parents, and who they raised them to be. I look at that with great sympathy and empathy for both sets of parents because they are hurting and that hurt won't go away. I, as a mother, cannot imagine having to answer for, defend, or address the actions of my child and knowing full well that I would go to bat for them no matter what, whether they were in this world still or not. So both parents I look at with a level of empathy, sympathy, and objectivity and don't judge them as grieving parents. Mm-hmm. But what I do not like, and I hope will not happen, is that either will contribute to a climate where, without more, people put the cart before the horse. I want everyone to see the full transcript. I want them to see all the basis for the appeals. I want them to have the opportunity to have the justice appellate process go forward because there is an opportunity. There is a chance with that Batson challenge, the one about the number of jurors who were struck who were of color, for that to have an impact on how the appellate court views this situation, whether it might be overturned as a conviction and retried in the future. And if that's the case, due process requires that there be a fairness for that defendant if he's retried, a fairness for the victim if the family goes through this trial again. And I would hate for the statements of either side to interrupt that pursuit of justice. And I'll just finally say this, Stephen, because you know full well the pressure of people wanting you to take a specific side of an issue. They'll question me as a woman, they'll question me as a mother, they'll question me as a Black person, they'll question me as a prosecutor, they'll question me on all sorts of things. Oh. And what I would say to all those people is, if you would like to judge, if you would like to use this young man or Austin Metcalf or Carmelo Anthony as an avatar for the fight that is and still will be, then do it with the conscience that is required of a child, 19 still a child in my mind, yeah, or the 19-year-old that is not there. Do it with the conscience of knowing these people are not your playthings. Right. These people are not just chess pieces for you to make a point. There are human beings right now who are in jail cells all across the country and in grave sites all across this country who don't deserve to be your playthings.
Last question, piggybacking right off of that. I don't mind being corrected at all. You know me, I'm open-minded. If I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. I'll correct it. It's no problem. My position, when I first learned about this, because I hadn't been following the case and I spoke about this Friday, and a lot of people have had comments about it, was simply this. My heart goes out to Carmelo Anthony because he's been sentenced to 35 years and isn't eligible for parole before 17 years have been served unless he's successful on an appeal. His life has been essentially destroyed. Yes. But he's still alive and Austin Metcalf is not. And so as a result of that, my attitude was, look, I don't think the 35-year sentence for a first-time offender at the age of 17 is fair. I think that's a bit too excessive, too egregious, especially when he wasn't judged, in my estimation, by a jury of his peers, even though there's no mandatory racial dynamic or demographic that needs to make up a jury. But the other side to it, I quoted his father. When his father was saying, everybody thinks about his grief, it's grief. He said, you know what it is? It's rage. That's what it is. And essentially what he was saying is that I sent my son to attract me and he never came home. And you've got to take that into consideration as well. So I don't like the 35-year sentence. And I think that needs to be probed to some degree. But in the same breath, a kid was killed. And all that happened prior to that was a shove. And because of that, he was killed. And there's no getting around that. And you have a lot of folks out there that have been in an uproar in regards to that. Have I said anything wrong?
I have not, in my estimation, based on the facts that came in, said anything that the prosecution did not present to a jury and allow them to judge. And I think in what is important here, I myself am a track mom, right? I have been at track meets. My kids track and AAU and all the different things that they do. And you watch people's tempers flare at events and you watch kids jostle each other and you watch shoves happen and you watch parents get too involved, all those things that happen. But that kid should have come home. And the idea of murder, the idea of a stabbing, the idea of believing that one put hands on me and I had to make a decision to kill someone because I thought I would be killed. People have a right to judge that based on the perspective that they have and what they believe should have been done. And I am so sad that that choice was made that day because both of those young men, they ought to be home right now. They ought to be thinking about college. They ought to be thinking about work. They ought to be thinking about girls. They ought to be thinking about whatever their love interests are. They ought to be thinking about whether they want to go see a movie this weekend. They should not be looking at one identical twin losing his brother in front of him, or a young 17-year-old, now 19, head shaven in an adult prison. That shouldn't have happened. But as much as people want to suggest that there are no consequences for the actions that are taken, that is wrong. There are consequences to the actions and the choices we all make. That was one of the hardest things I had to deal with as a prosecutor, Stephen A., because I told you, I didn't deal with monsters. I dealt with human beings who were fallible, who made the wrong choice, who made the wrong decision. And you know what? They were held to account. They were held to account. And as unfair as that may be to people. That is the system that we have. Now, whether you think the amount of time you should spend is wrong, take issue with it. The parole board is going to take issue with it in about 15 to 17 years. The appellate court is going to take issue with it very, very soon. And think about whether it was the appropriate decision to even have him tried and have those different jury instructions read to give two options, whether it was wrong for the prosecutor to make any statements they may have made at trial, whether the sentencing was wrong, whether the jury composition is wrong. All those things come into play. But if you are of the mindset that when a wrong is done, somebody ought to be held to account, whether it's in politics, whether it's an adult, whether it's a trial judge, whether it's a traffic violation, then you have to be consistent that accountability is the result. And I think at the end of the day, Stephen A., the reason my heart hurts, because I know why people are torn. I mean, you're looking at a Black woman. I know why people think about the justice system. But what about the 17-year-old who was also killed? What would justice look like for him? And what would have been the demand for justice had it been the reverse? Had it been a Black 17-year-old killed by a white 17-year-old? What would the communities have demanded then? And whether or not justice, people believe, would have been served, what is the demand you would have made? And then what is the reason you would have made that demand? And I hear you. When my kids come home from track meets, when it's raining and they've got the tents out, when I'm sitting next to them and some kid wants to go under a tent and sit there and be free from the rain, both kids should have come home. I cannot imagine getting that call.
Laura Coates, weeknights, the Laura Coates Show on CNN. Always a pleasure having you. You know, I always appreciate you edifying my audience. Always appreciate you, period. Thank you so much.
Wishing you
nothing but the best, and I'll see you soon. You know, I'm always here for you.
Thank you, Stephen A. I appreciate it.
Thank you. One only, Laura Coates from CNN. That's it for this edition of Straight Shooter. You heard what she had to say. You know where I stand. I've already said what I had to say. She articulated the reasons why. Nobody wins here. I'm not happy that Carmelo Anthony got 35 years. I think that should be revisited. But there is no doubt that he killed a young man, and only a shove preceded it. It was unnecessary, and both kids should have been home. One's not going home because he's going to jail eventually. Another is not ever coming home because he passed away. That's the reality, no matter which way you want to slice it. That's it for this edition of Straight Shooter. I'll holler at y'all Wednesday night, Sirius XM, POTUS Radio, Channel 124. Make sure you don't miss it. Until then, peace and love, everybody. Talk to you soon.